Blog Talk Radio.
Yo, 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 I want to dedicate this to my mama.
What's up, man? You
ain't got no name. We just from Compton.
Say ya.
Wait,
y'all ain't been together, man.
Later, man.
What's the group's name?
New Kids in the Hood.
Yo, man, we got the right stuff.
Hit it.
Rolling, strolling, it's kind of like bowling. My head's getting big and it looks kind of swollen. Hip hopping, body rocking.
Yeah. I'm MC Mallet.
Yeah.
And these are 45.
Yeah.
And we finna get busy, girls. Run it. Mallet. 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 I am.
Mallet. Mallet.
Dre, we still haven't found the perfect rapper yet.
Yeah.
How many
yeah.
groups we got out there?
I don't know. Let me see.
Come on, y'all. We don't need this.
Hey, man, is that it?
Man, you ain't gonna believe it. There's about 1,000 of them out there. I think I'm asleep on it.
Yeah, let's do that.
See ya.
The rhythm, this is what I'm using to come up with a style, so I'll interact altogether better with the crowd. Nervous for a second and the record starts spinning, and I fall into the state of mind of what I've just created. Pumping like the doctor, the into the RE suckers ready to leap up on the tip when we made it. Creative, so I'll never be regarded as a regular, more than just a little bit better than my competitor. You should never underestimate the fashion. I hope for the same, whether I'm cooling or thrashing. Cracking the concoction created by me. When read, you read, C equals the D O to the C. Knowledge and the talent that my mother had born. Now her equals an artist, I won't be born. What is that, Dre?
It's the formula.
But those who wanna comprehend will again be in the midst of a brother. Unlike another in any way, cause Trey don't play, say what the others say. Originality is a must whenever I bust. The funky composition is crushed and I trust that you know it when you hear a funky record with potential. Be getting hyped for Trey rocking the instrumental. Nothing like what you've heard before and more. Never let see, I don't fess. I mean, I'm like fresh if not the freshest. When I'm expressing my thoughts on, body you can help but listen up and get caught on. Because I cook when I pick up a pen and begin in the end. It's dope, that's cause I wanna win. Knowledge and the talent that my mother had born to her equals a doc, what is it, Dre?
Yo, man, that's the formula.
Making each record that I do better than the last one. Take a little time, choose the topic and drop it, release it to science. I'm making dope beats with rhythmic American poetry. Shift at the stations, now many people know of me. I'm the D into the O and the O into the C and the C into the period. Suckers are fearing this when under dope style calculated by the great. Waiting 6 seconds to get caught up in my record. New but not a kid to be born. If something's getting torn up, then I'm doing the tearing, not being torn. Shaping up to be one of the top vocalists, lyricists, and when you hear of this, you shouldn't choke on this. Knowledge and the talent makes it valid for me to get it patent. Trick, tell them what I'm rapping.
The formula.
Thank you.
Enhance your mind. Recharge your spirit. Awaken your soul. Enhancing Awareness Radio. Enhancing awareness with clarity.
All right, guys, go back and check out part one. I did part one. I did two podcasts today. One of them was great. Just well, this weekend, guys, it was Cosmic Update. Shit that, you know, universally you feel that I feel. Excuse me, that you need to know. And 9/11, shit, since it's 9/11, you know, last minute I was like 9/11. So since it's 9/11, guys, I just, you know, the lecture that I had found years ago that gave me some insight. And there is a lecture out there called The Rise of the Cabal, or The Fall of the Cabal. There it is, Fall of the Cabal, which is like a two-hour-long lecture, but it's chopped up also in like 30 pieces, 30, you know, segments, right? So this one has 29 segments. So I'm not sure what we left off on the last one, but I just hopped right in. This is 18. So this is 18. And the lecture is called The Ring of Power on YouTube. So the YouTube lecture called Ring of Power is chopped up into 29 segments. And this is segment 18. Go back and look at part one for, you know, pretty much all of the others. But the clip to the lecture, the playlist actually is going to be in the show notes. Definitely in the show notes on the first one. But if it's not in the show notes on the second one, it's going to be in the show notes on the first one. So be sure that you go and do your own research on that. 18 out of 29.
Throughout history have always been waged by the ruling master class for conquest, power, and profit. And the subject class have always fought their battles. It wasn't until the close of World War I that soldiers began to ask why they were killing and being killed. The League of Nations was the money cartel's first attempt at world control, but Tsar Nicholas II of Russia caught on to their plot and sabotaged it. That proved to be a deadly mistake. Schiff, Warburg, Rockefeller, Harriman, and Morgan risings that led to the 1917 Russian Revolution. Their strategy was to finance both sides of wars and revolutions, which gave them control over the winners, the losers, and the outcomes.
The execution and removal of the bodies took 20 minutes. Three centuries of Tsarist Russia were gone.
Between 1918 and 1921, 14 million Russians died from war and starvation under Lenin's Bolsheviks. By 1919, Lenin ran up a national debt to the Rothschild banksters of $60 billion, which put Russia firmly under their control. As Mayor Rothschild once said, "Give me control of a nation's money and I care not who makes her laws." To this day, the Rothschilds have stopped the heirs to the Tsar's fortunes from claiming their deposits held in Rothschild banks. Those fortunes are now worth an estimated $60 billion. Joseph Stalin, who was financed by the same money cartel, replaced Lenin as Russia's brutal new dictator. Using terror and death threats, Stalin's job was to industrialize Russia and turn communism into a powerful counterforce to democracy. Manufactured conflict between these two powerful political forces would be the ideal excuse for all future wars and for dividing, conquering, and ruling the world.
Prosperity in the United States. The instalment plans were created to make buying high-priced items more affordable.
Instead of shelling out $100 for a new washing machine, consumers would put $5 down and pay $8 a month. The dangers of debt and high interest rates didn't enter the minds of most Americans, and shopping raged throughout the decade. Advertising became part of the fabric of American culture as ads dominated newspapers and magazines. Sex appeal, social snobbery, outrageous claims, and fabricated scientific studies convinced consumers to buy more.
With massive corporate growth, high employment, and a post-war bull market on Wall Street, first-time American investors went on a stock market buying spree.
One wanted a piece of this prosperity. People bought stock on margin or credit for as little as 10% down. They then used the stock as collateral to borrow more money to buy more stock. Then they did it again. The market was a free-for-all with no regulations of any kind.
The party ended on October 29, 1929, when the stock market crashed and caught everyone off guard, everyone except the banksters. J.P. Morgan and Kuhn and Loeb sent advance warnings to their group of insiders. These Federal Reserve pirates caused the crash by printing a whopping 62% inflation rate, then raising interest rates to an alarming 6%. While the Rothschilds, Warburgs, and other Federal Reserve pirates escaped the fallout, outsiders lost everything, some of them leaping to their death from office towers. 30 of the $80 billion that industrial stocks have been worth vanished into thin air. The thin air was just another name for the international banksters. Following the crash, the Great Depression put one-third of the U.S. workforce out of work. The bankster-owned banks foreclosed on property and took possession of people's homes and farms. When panicked citizens lined up at banks to withdraw their hard-earned savings, the banksters gave them only 10 cents on the dollar. Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow decided to do something about it. Homeless and desperate, many Americans set up tent cities and rode the rails looking for work.
I went walking that river highway, I saw a bug in the skyway, saw below me that golden valley, the highway.
We don't want to overlook the fact that this country was on the brink of hell. We were looking and searching for anything to get us out of this. Communism looked very, very attractive to people. I was working to share everything. We, you don't have to worry about being out of a job. We could be one great big happy family. Well, it won't be word, but that we believed it.
Either on the trains or in the jungles, you do get to talking about what this means in a broader sense, the social struggle. Why does it have to be this way when the goddamn guys on Wall Street all got millions of dollars? And I can remember being aware of the difference between the working class and the ruling class, which is Clyde, to put it in the terms that I use today.
Boys come a-chandy, and the fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me.
Congressman Louis McFadden, chairman of the House Banking Committee, claimed the crash was planned by the international bankers who sought to become rulers of us all. In his famous 1932 congressional address, he said, "Mr. Chairman, we have in this country one of the most corrupt institutions the world has ever known. I refer to the Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve Bank. The Federal Reserve Board has cheated the people of the United States out of enough money to pay the national debt three times over. This evil institution has impoverished and ruined the people of the United States through the defects of the law which it operates and through the corrupt practices of the moneyed vultures who control it. Some people think the Federal Reserve Banks are government institutions. They are not government institutions. They are private credit monopolies which prey upon the people of the United States for the benefit of themselves. Following a series of death threats, McFadden died from food poisoning, followed by a heart attack under suspicious circumstances. In his book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, Professor Anthony B. Sutton shows documented evidence that U.S. corporations supplied money, gas, vehicles, and weaponry that helped Hitler launch World War II. Prescott Bush, father of George Bush and grandfather of George W. Bush, supplied raw materials and funneled vast sums of money and credit to Hitler's Third Reich. Under Trading with the Enemies Act, the U.S. government seized businesses operated by Prescott Bush and Skull and Bonesman Avril Harriman, including New York's Union Banking Corporation. These seizures were based on evidence that Bush and Harriman had been operating front organizations for Hitler's Third Reich. Their German partner was a notorious Nazi industrialist named Fritz Thyssen, who wrote a book of confessions called I Paid Hitler. Professor Sutton lists Rockefeller Standard Oil, Henry Ford's Ford Motor Company, J.P. Morgan's General Electric, ITT, and the DuPont as suppliers for Germany's rearmament program. But why on earth would Jewish bankers and corporations finance a monster like Adolf Hitler? It is a well-known fact that Adolf Hitler went to great lengths to cover up his family history, even arranging for the assassination of Austrian Chancellor Dollfuss, who investigated Hitler's family. The Dollfuss file, now in the hands of the British Secret Service, reveals that Adolf Hitler's grandmother named Maria Anna Schickelgruber worked in Vienna as a live-in housemaid at Solomon Rothschild's manor next to his hotel. The information was traced through her compulsory registration card. Solomon Rothschild was one of Mayor Rothschild's five banker sons. Separated from his wife, Solomon had a reputation with police as a lecherous womanizer. When Maria Anna Schickelgruber's pregnancy was discovered, she was dismissed. Adolf Hitler, the grandson of Solomon Rothschild, earned a reputation as the most evil man the world has ever known. But more evil than Adolf Hitler were the men who created and financed him. Hitler's revolutionary activities in Germany landed him in prison for 5 years. This so-called prison was Landsberg Castle, a comfortable, privileged pastoral setting where Hitler was groomed for the job of Führer. His coaches, Rudolf Hess and Hermann Göring, helped him write the infamous book Mein Kampf. Nazi rocket scientist Wernher von Braun, who built German rockets and dropped them on London, was also put on the new CIA payroll. Von Braun and his team of Nazi rocketeers were sent to Huntsville, Alabama. Hollywood honored Von Braun as a collaborator on an American sci-fi movie and series of Walt Disney shows. Let's take you back to 1958-59, and I'm suddenly required to work with a Nazi. I grew up in World War II. Now, you couldn't expect me to suddenly have great love for somebody that came out of Peter Mundy and was firing rockets at the people in England and blowing them up, and furthermore had been in Peter Mundy where he had slave labor, etc. So how am I supposed to suddenly like that guy? The international banksters and the men who served them had won the American, Russian, and British versions of monopoly by seizing control of the Bank of England and the U.S. Federal Reserve, and by wiping out the Russian Tsar. But the ultimate goal of the banksters was to win the world game. Their devious game plan was to divide the world into two warring power blocks, the Western capitalist bloc led by the United States and the Eastern communist bloc led by Russia. Their next move was to transfer atomic weapons secrets to their Russian communist bloc through Viktor Rothschild, who was the ringleader in Britain's biggest communist spy scandal, and through J. Robert Oppenheimer, the Manhattan Project leading atomic scientist.
In September 1949, the Soviet Union exploded its first A-bomb. America's monopoly on atomic weapons ended after only 4 years. Now, both superpowers had the means to destroy the world.
The next step was to stage a phony arms race and Cold War between their first world capitalist bloc and second world communist bloc. The U.S. and Russian superpowers needed recruits for their war games, so they forced new third world members of the United Nations to choose sides. American Secretary of State John Foster Dulles warned third world countries that you're either with us or you're against us. Korea and Vietnam were torn up like rags into half-communist, half-capitalist countries and became the playing field for phony war games between the bankster superpowers.
Marilyn Monroe in Korea, America's great sex symbol, innocent and alluring, caught in the blood and mud of the Korean War. To the battle-weary soldiers who bathed her, she must have looked like an angel sent from heaven to ease the pain of fighting a godforsaken war in a far-off land.
The lives of 4 million Korean civilians and 33,000 American soldiers were sacrificed in the 1950 Korean War, bringing the banksters another step closer to world domination. Like Korea, Vietnam was split into North and South Vietnam and became their next target. In 1954, the U.S. military dropped millions of tons of bombs on undefended Vietnamese civilians and turned their lush green countryside into blood-red killing fields. It was a butcherous campaign of terror, rape, torture, lies, and cover-ups. The U.S. military, who had already tested two radioactive atomic weapons of mass destruction on the people of Japan, decided to test their chemical weapons of mass destruction on the people of Vietnam. $70 million liters of chemical weapons of mass destruction were sprayed over the Vietnamese people, their water, and their countryside. The most lethal was Agent Orange, which defoliated, killed, and contaminated everything in its path like a radioactive atomic bomb. To this day, survivors suffer related cancers, genetic deformities, and permanent environmental damage. Many U.S. servicemen publicly confessed to their crimes and suffered haunting flashbacks. In spite of massive U.S. war protests, President Nixon increased America's military presence in Vietnam to 500,000 soldiers by 1969. It was Nobel Peace Prize winner Henry Kissinger who convinced Nixon to expand the Vietnam War to the neighboring countries of Cambodia and Laos, causing the mass murder of another 1 million innocent people and their families. On May 4, 1970, America got a wake-up call. Six peaceful anti-war student demonstrators from Kent State and Jackson State universities
were shot dead by U.S. armed guards, while dozens of others were wounded. The message came through loud and clear, the power of the U.S. military to turn its weapons on its own citizens. In 1947, the United States played host to an international conference at Bretton Woods to put an end to world poverty and starvation caused by World War II. The idea was to give humanitarian loans to needy nations by creating a World Bank and an International Monetary Fund. But who would be put in charge of these billion-dollar mega loans? Who else but the U.S. Federal Reserve bankster families? Putting the U.S. Federal Reserve banksters in charge of humanitarian loans is like putting pedophiles in charge of daycare centers. Instead of helping the poor, the banksters turned the World Bank and International Monetary Fund into international pawn shops and robbed the poor. For a loan, desperate nations were forced to pawn their mines, forests, railways, power companies, and water systems, and agree to over 100 loan conditions at loan shark interest rates. To pay off the loans, they were forced to ignore laws that protected their environment, to lower wages, and to cut back on their education and on their health care. They were also forced to privatize and sell off their resources to crooked corporations like Enron. Lord Wacom, the director of N.M. Rothschild & Sons, was on the audit committee of Enron and cooked the book and sucked billions from pension funds and investors before declaring bankruptcy. When poor nations were unable to pay their loans, they were given new loans to pay off the old loans. But these so-called bailout loans weren't about bailing out the poor. They were about bailing out and lining the pockets of loan underwriters like Citigroup and America's most notorious crooks and banksters. As desperately poor nations got more desperately poor, the filthy rich banksters got filthier rich, and God help anybody who got in their way. Davidson Budu, senior economist for the International Monetary Fund, resigned to, quote, wash my hands of the blood of millions of poor and starving people. When President John F. Kennedy tried to take back America by reviving U.S. government printed money, his head was blown off in a Dallas motorcade. When his son planned to expose the ugly truth about his father's assassination, his small plane plunged into the ocean, killing all on board. In the 1950s, a weapon was invented that has become more powerful than America's deadliest weapons of mass destruction. It is the weapon of mass deception, and it is right in our own living rooms. The hypnotizing world of picture television brings us the news of the world through two central news agencies called Reuters and the Associated Press. The Rothschilds bought Reuters in the 1800s, which later bought the Associated Press and made the Rothschild family owners of the world's largest central news services. To the present day, the world depends on these Rothschild-owned central news services as their main source of news and information. In his book called Who Owns the TV Network, author Eustace Mullins claims that the major TV networks, radio stations, newspapers, and publishing empires are controlled by the Rothschild, Rockefeller, and J.P. Morgan money cartels through their corporate conglomerates. The Bankster-owned media conglomerates include weapons manufacturers General Electric and Westinghouse, which profit from promoting wars. Their man in Washington is head of the FCC Federal Communications Commission, and his name is Michael Powell, the son of Colin Powell. Michael Powell was put in charge of changes to the media monopoly rules and who can own what. Joining public opposition to Michael Powell's FCC deregulation policies, Senator Byron Dorgan had this to say.
Seldom have I seen a regulatory agency cave in so completely to the big economic interests. That's exactly what happened today with the FCC rules. And Chairman Powell kept suggesting slight modifications. It's not slight at all. This is a big deal. It's going to affect what the American people can see, can hear, can read. Let me emphasize something that was in your setup piece. After what the FCC did today, it is likely, in fact, that in big American cities, we will see the same company own the newspaper, 3 television stations, 8 radio stations, and the cable system in that city, all under one company. And I don't know what happened to this notion of competition, but I'm telling you, it's not there. It's not embedded anywhere in the FCC's decision. Well, I'm just going to have to say this. There are a lot of lies. In his new book, Brock says the key to the success of the right-wing media is opinion, predicated on a raft of distortions, misrepresentations, and outright lies presented to the readers and viewers as fact. I think it used to be...
Control over the internet, publishing, recording, and top cable companies can be traced back to the same big 5 media empires, General Electric, Time Warner, Viacom, Disney, and News Corp. These media monopolies are owned directly or indirectly by the Rothschild, J.P. Morgan, Rockefeller, and Oppenheimer Brotherhood. Yes, there are now more stations and more media voices, but they're all coming from the same ventriloquist, says Senator Dorgan. TV show needs corporate sponsors, and corporate sponsors sponsor pro-business, pro-government programming, and journalists who support the agenda of the big 5 media owners. While 2/3 of the world goes hungry, these banksters offer gazillion-dollar sponsorships to sports athletes to play with their balls. Why? Because they keep the masses distracted from the important issues, like the passage of the Patriot Act to limit your civil rights and freedoms.
That allows the government to come into your home, take things from your home, search your home, and never tell you about it.
Increasingly, however, Americans are speaking out.
The media and banking monopolists now have the power to make or break political leaders around the globe. Why haven't the networks made a TV movie of the week about how the Bush family made their family fortune? The movie could be called The Awful Truth, starring George W.'s great-grandfather, Samuel P. Bush, whose Buckeye Steel Casting Company supplies parts for Edward Harriman's railroad, who in turn provides rail shipments for John D. Rockefeller Standard Oil, who in turn gets monopoly financing from the Rothschilds. The movie could be made into a TV series starring Samuel's son, Prescott Bush, as the managing director of a Nazi steel manufacturing plant in Poland called Silesian Consolidated Steel. In episode 1, Prescott Bush forwards American financing to his German partner, Fritz Thyssen, through the Union Banking Corporation in New York. Fritz Thyssen arranges a contract with Nazi Germany's IG Farben Company for free Jewish slave labor in Bush's steel manufacturing plant at the Auschwitz concentration camp. Episode 2 shows Skull and Bonesman Prescott Bush and Avril Harriman getting caught under Trading with the Enemy Act, as the U.S. government moves in and seizes all of their shares in Union Banking Corporation. In episode 3, Prescott's son, the first George Bush, is director of the CIA. George puts drug king Manuel Noriega on the CIA payroll, allowing thousands of tons of cocaine to hit the streets of America via the Panama Canal. In episode 4,
George's son, the second George Bush, becomes partnered with Osama bin Laden's older brother, Salem bin Laden, in a Texas oil company called Arbusto Energy. Episode 5 introduces George W. Shady younger brother, Neil Bush, ripping off the elderly in the Silverado savings and loan scandal that cost U.S. taxpayers $1.3 billion. In Episode 6, the Florida election is fixed by George W.'s older brother, Jeb Bush, who puts brother George into the top job at the White House, which brings us back to Auschwitz and the concluding episode with George W. Bush visiting the slave labor camp where his grandfather helped build the Bush family fortune on free Jewish slave labor.
Besides, a sobering reminder that of the power of evil and the need for people to resist evil.
As a follow-up to the TV series, an award show could celebrate the 20-year friendship of the Bush and Bin Laden families and their shared investment in the Carlyle Group. The Carlyle Group is one of America's largest weapons contractors. For the Bush and Bin Laden families, war means profit, big profit. Although the media creates the illusion of freedom of the press, the dominant opinion and messages always serve the banksters' agenda. Messages like, support your troops or you're a traitor to America. But who are the troops? Many are teenagers whose childhood entertainment was shooting out the blood and guts of virtual people in places that are virtually real. Now they're blowing up real people in places that are really real, like schools, hospitals, and villages filled with families and children.
Burns, open wounds, amputations, spinal cord injuries, broken bones, eyes that have been sprayed with shrapnel. The list is long and predictable.
The chilling reality is that up to 15% of the tax money deducted from your paycheck each month buys the bombs and pays the salaries of troops to commit these atrocities. Rivers of blood from innocent families and their children is on everybody's hands. The plan for world domination by the banksters cannot be accomplished without your cooperation. That plan was formulated in 1773 at Mayor Rothschild's goldsmith shop by 13 influential German Jewish families. Among them were Rothschild, Oppenheimer, Warburg, and Schiff. Their formula for global control is the 3M formula: money control, media control, and military control. Like changes to the rules that gave these families the media and money monopolies, new laws are being passed to transfer military control to them by privatizing the military. But if they're killing terrorists, who cares if they are government soldiers or corporate soldiers? A more important question to ask is, who exactly are the terrorists and where do terrorists get their training? The answer is right smack in America at Fort Benning, Georgia. Until January 2001, America's terrorist training school was called School of the Americas. But because of massive protests against its activities, the name was changed to WISC, Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. Actress Susan Sarandon narrated a documentary film called School of the Assassins. The film exposes the school as a terrorist training camp whose graduates are well-known murderers, torturers, state terrorists, and dictators, including drug king Manuel Noriega. The role of terrorists in the bankster-owned media is to scare the living tax dollars out of citizens, and timing is everything. On the second anniversary of the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center, George Bush asked for an $87 billion increase in military spending. On the second anniversary of the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center, George Bush asked for an $87 billion increase in military spending. At the same time, the media released a dramatic video showing Osama bin Laden alive and well and threatening to make the 9-1-1 attack seem like foreplay. How much do we really know about America's favorite villain? Multimillionaire Osama bin Laden was the 17th of 52 children fathered by a wealthy construction baron named Mohammed bin Laden, who had close ties to the Saudi royal family and the Bush family. In 1979, the American CIA and Pakistan's ISI financed an anti-Soviet group in Afghanistan and provoked a profitable 10-year war with the Russians. When the Russians invaded Afghanistan, the CIA hired Osama bin Laden to recruit and train al-Qaeda fighters to fight the Russian army.
Every communist group in Afghanistan have been at the front line in the fight against the threat of communism.
But what was the fight really all about? Not carrots or potatoes. It was about poppies, endless fields of opium poppies that provide over 70% of the world's heroin supply to heroin addicts worldwide.
Very uncomfortable issues for politicians. It was a dramatic story, but the media failed to tell us the less heroic side of Afghanistan's freedom fighters. America's new friends had become hooked on the economics of the poppy. During the war, many of the Mujahideen radically increased the production of opium, the raw ingredient of heroin.
The international drug trade began in 1606 when Queen Elizabeth I filled England's well by trafficking illegal opium from India to China. British East India Shipping Company and profited handsomely, not just from drug trafficking, but from trafficking African slaves with her slave trader, John Hawkins. First, knighted her slave trader with the noble title of Sir John Hawkins. By 1830, the British had distanced themselves from dope dealing by granting opium monopoly rights to the Jewish Sassoon family, who became known as the Rothschilds of the Far East. As an agent for the crown, David Sassoon shared his dope profits with Queen Victoria.
The British East India Company built a major factory to process the opium here at Gazapur. It's still a lucrative earner for the Indian government, which sells opiates to the world's pharmaceutical industry.
When the Chinese banned opium and destroyed 600 chest loads of the addictive drug, Sassoon and the British retaliated.
It was a financial disaster for the British. With huge profits at stake, they retaliated with the Opium Wars of 1843 and 1858. The forces of the Mark were to defeat China's moral prohibition.
Sassoon and the British forced drug addiction onto an entire nation, sold the island of Hong Kong, and made Hong Kong the capital of the British international drug trade. In 1872, Queen Victoria knighted David Sassoon's son, Albert Sassoon, who spread the illegal opium trade throughout China and Japan. In 1887, Sir Albert Sassoon married Aline Carolyn Rothschild and joined the pirated fortunes of the Sassoon drug cartel with the Rothschild money cartel. Today, it's business as usual for the descendants of the Sassoon and Rothschild families who socialize with Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Charles as elite members of Britain's inner power circle. Many have been granted royal titles like Sir, Countess, Baron, and Marquis, but their many victims aren't fooled by the crowns, the titles, and the tuxedos.
They have very different titles for them. Titles like liars, thieves, dope dealers, and mass murderers for the crown. On the other side of the Atlantic, a member of the same opium smuggling syndicate, Samuel Russell, founded Yale University's Skull and Bones Brotherhood with drug money. Exclusive members were financed into political power positions in the CIA, the U.S. Supreme Court, and the White House. When Skull and Bonesman George Bush Sr. became CIA director in the 1980s, the CIA recruited Osama bin Laden to train al-Qaeda and Mujahideen fighters in Afghanistan. The job of Osama's trainees was not just to fight the Russian communists, it was to run Afghanistan's multi-billion dollar opium trade. Heroin, manufactured from Afghan opium, supplied $250 to $300 billion annually to Wall Street and the U.S. banks. Authors Alfred McCoy and Michael Levine tied the CIA to this unholy drug alliance and received national attention when the CIA tried to suppress their books.
Michael Levine became a best-selling author when he wrote about his experience of this unholy alliance. After 30 years
of opium poppies that provide over 70% of the world's heroin supply to heroin addicts worldwide.
Very uncomfortable. Issues for politicians.
Maybe y'all can't live here.
The media is now on the left-wing side of Afghanistan's freedom fighters. America's new friends have become crypto economics of the poppy. During the war, many of the Mujahideen radically increased the production of opium, the raw ingredient of heroin.
The international drug trade began in 1606 when Queen Elizabeth I filled England's wealth by trafficking illegal opium from India to China. British East India Shipping Company and profited handsomely, not just from drug trafficking, but from trafficking African slaves with her slave trader, John Hawkins. First, knighted her slave trader with the noble title of Sir John Hawkins. By 1830, the British had distanced themselves from dope dealing by granting opium monopoly rights to the Jewish Sassoon family, who became known as the Rothschilds of the Far East. As an agent for the crown, David Sassoon shared his dope profits with Queen Victoria.
The British East India Company built a major factory to process the opium here at Gaziantep. It's still a lucrative earner for the Indian government, which sells opium to the world's pharmaceutical industry.
When the Chinese banned opium and destroyed 600 chest loads of the addictive drug, Sassoon and the British retaliated.
It was a financial disaster for the British. With huge profits at stake, they retaliated with the Opium Wars of 1843 and 1858. This is the market where the defeat of China's moral prohibition.
Sassoon and the British forced drug addiction onto an entire nation, stole the island of Hong Kong, and made Hong Kong the capital of the British international drug trade. In 1872, Queen Victoria knighted David Sassoon's son, Albert Sassoon, who spread the illegal opium trade throughout China and Japan. In 1887, Sir Albert Sassoon married Aline Caroline Rothschild and joined the pirated fortunes of the Sassoon drug cartel with the Rothschild money cartel. Today, it's business as usual
or the descendants of the Sassoon and Rothschild family, who socialized with Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Charles as elite members of Britain's inner power circle. Many have been granted royal titles, like Sir, Countess, Baron, and Marquis, but their many victims aren't fooled by the crowns, the titles, and the tuxedos. They have very different titles for them. Titles like liars, thieves, dope dealers, and mass murderers for the crown. On the other side of the Atlantic, a member of the same opium-smuggling syndicate, Samuel Russell, founded Yale University's Skull and Bones Brotherhood with drug money. Exclusive members were financed into political power positions in the CIA, the U.S. Supreme Court, and the White House. When Skull and Bones and George Bush Sr. became CIA director in the 1980s, the CIA recruited Osama bin Laden to train al-Qaeda and Mujahideen fighters in Afghanistan. The job of Osama's trainees was not just to fight the Russian communists, but to run Afghanistan's multi-billion dollar opium trade. Heroin, manufactured from Afghan opium, supplied $250 to $300 billion annually to Wall Street and the U.S. banks. Authors Alfred McCoy and Michael Levine tied the CIA to this unholy drug alliance and received national attention when the CIA tried to suppress their books.
Michael Levine became a best-selling author when he wrote about his experience of this unholy alliance. After 30 years' distinguished service with the DEA, he could write with some authority. You could look at what they did to me as an example in microcosm of Central Intelligence's actions and the State Department in completely subverting the drug war. You know, the drug war was something that only existed in the minds of Americans, on the streets of America, for kids like my brother, for cops who died. There was no drug war. The biggest drug dealers in the world were given a license to sell drugs to Americans to support themselves. And this continued right down from Southeast Asia through
But how was the heroin smuggled into the United States? One of America's most gruesome secrets is that during the Vietnam War, heroin was smuggled into the United States by hiding it inside the body bags of dead American soldiers. By the end of the 1960s, one-third of U.S. soldiers in Vietnam and close to 1 million United States citizens were hooked on heroin. Drugs like LSD, mescaline, marijuana, and hashish also swamp the streets and college campuses of America. Who or what turned America's youth onto these illegal drugs? Celebrity anti-war activists like Aldous Huxley, Timothy Leary, Allen Ginsberg, and Bertrand Russell sold America's youth on acid rock, tripping out, and one world government. Their financing came from the Warburg banksters and IPF, Institute for Policy Studies. Over 100 million doses of LSD that hit the streets of America were purchased by Timothy Leary and Alan Dulles through S.G. Warburg Sandoz AB Pharmaceutical Company in Switzerland. Three sample-sized packages of acid were handed out not only on college campuses, but at rock concerts, where musicians persuaded millions of fans to critics of the drug culture blame parents, teachers, law enforcement, and everybody except the people behind it all, namely the Rothschild-Warburg banksters and their Committee of 300. According to Dr. John Coleman, who wrote the story of the Committee of 300, the Beatles rock group were brought to America by the Tavistock Institute. Tavistock launched the drug culture revolution in America to popularize and normalize social drug use. Through their record companies and advertising monopolies, the banksters have packaged and financed their celebrity salesmen to anesthetize, addict, and enslave billions of people worldwide with dependencies on both prescription and non-prescription, legal and illegal drugs. Those drugs range from alcohol, nicotine, and caffeine to Prozac, crack cocaine, and heroin. Like the phony war on terrorism, the phony war on drugs is a cat and mouse game being fought with one hand and fed with the other. The peace symbol adopted by the drug flower children of the 60s The peace symbol adopted.
Okay. That was one.
In the 1950s, a weapon was invented that has become more powerful than a mix. The peace symbol adopted by the drug flower children of the 24 was designed by Gerald Holcomb, who was commissioned by One World Government salesman Bertrand Russell. The symbol was never designed as a symbol of peace, but as a symbol of death. It is actually a cross turned upside down with the arms broken and is used by Satanists and in Druid witchcraft. In Germany, the symbol is known as the death rune and is found on tombstones of Hitler's Nazi SS officers. CIA's team of ex-Nazis and Skull and Bonesmen financed and trained Osama bin Laden, who pushed the Russians out of Afghanistan by 1989. The CIA then trained and installed the ruthless Taliban regime to run the booming opium trade. After a decade, the long friendship between America and the Taliban suddenly turned ugly. At a meeting held on December 4, 1997 at UNICAL headquarters, American oil men made a proposal to the Taliban about building a pipeline to Afghanistan. Rothschild Shell Oil and Rockefeller's Exxon Oil had invested billions in the Kazakhstan oil and gas reserves just north of Afghanistan. Now they needed a pipeline to transport it to the Persian Gulf. The Taliban demanded a bigger cut and turned down the proposal. Suddenly, the banksters' American-controlled media were calling the Taliban monsters, evildoers, and cruel villains who beat up on women. On July 4, 1999, President Clinton froze the Taliban's U.S. assets and bank accounts and imposed trade sanctions on Afghanistan. By February 2001, the Taliban destroyed most of Afghanistan's opium crops. In May, Secretary of State Colin Powell announced a gift of $43 million U.S. taxpayers' dollars to the Taliban. He called it a reward to the Taliban for destroying the opium crops. But members of the new George W. Bush White House knew the Taliban would use the $43 million for more sinister purposes.
Larger issues, not just not connecting the dots, but not getting the dots. Why was it that CIA was unable to collect information for years inside Afghanistan when they had authority to kill bin Laden for over 2.5 years? Why were they unable to kill him or his lieutenants? Why didn't they have a better capability to do something about it at the source?
Could it be that the banksters-supported U.S. administration is controlling both sides of the war on terror? Before the first plane ever even hit the first tower on 911, a massive U.S., British, and NATO troop buildup was already organized and positioned for an attack on Israel's enemies, opium-rich Afghanistan and oil-rich Iraq.
And there's an old poster out west that I recall that said, wanted, dead or alive.
With no solid proof of who was responsible for 9-1-1, George Bush Jr. attacked the poverty-stricken, war-ravaged country of Afghanistan only 4 weeks after 9-1-1. The U.S. and British military dropped 12,000 bombs on thousands of buildings and homes, pounding them into dust and rubble and killing 8,000 Afghan people. 20,000 more people died from war-related cold, starvation, and disease. Nobody made a big-budget TV production out of the massacre with a God Bless Afghanistan movie score. The U.S.-British war on Afghanistan left behind millions of starving people and thousands of women who are still veiled, still homeless, and still penniless.
Afghanistan is the world's largest producer of opium and now the world's largest producer of heroin.
There can never be peace and democracy in Afghanistan. Why? Because peace and democracy would expose and cut off corporate America's opium and heroin trade at the source. So what was the payoff for the U.S.-British war on Afghanistan? One, the uncooperative Taliban warlords got kicked out and replaced by the cooperative Northern Alliance warlords. Two, opium and heroin production and revenue skyrocketed. Three, Afghanistan got a new leader named Hamid Karzai, who just happened to be an ex-employee of Unocal Oil. Three, America got permission to build their oil and gas pipeline through Afghanistan. And four, the Bush administration's favorite excuse for war, Osama bin Laden, was allowed to escape. America's second favorite excuse for war, Saddam Hussein, has always been America's patsy. In the 1980s, the United States supported Iraq's invasion of its neighbor, Iran, to stop the spread of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Sides of the Iran-Iraq war by supplying Saddam with chemical and biological weapons of mass destruction. And at the same time, America secretly sold weapons to Iran and illegally diverted the money to the contra-revolutionaries in Central America.
During the war, the United States sent a special envoy to see Saddam in 1983. This is Donald Rumsfeld, now the U.S. Defense Secretary. The two discussed how to reinforce Iraq against a common enemy. This was at a time when Iraq was using chemical weapons on Iranian troops. U.S. companies were supplying components with Washington's knowledge.
By 1990, President George Bush Sr. tricked Iraq into another war with another oil-rich neighbor, Kuwait. How? By supplying Kuwait with horizontal drills that could reach beneath the border of Iraq and siphon oil from Iraq's oil fields. Kuwait used the U.S.-made drills to steal 300,000 barrels of oil per day from Iraq, worth over $3 billion annually.
The fuse was lit, and Kuwait did nothing to put it out. They pumped oil without restraint from Rumaila oil field, which was accessible to both Kuwait and Iraq, and they exceeded OPEC quotas, flooding the market and driving prices even lower.
George Bush Sr. officially promised not to interfere in Iraq's legitimate oil battle with Kuwait, but when Saddam's army entered Kuwait to defend their oil reserves, Bush pounced on them.
Our goal is not the conquest of Iraq. It is the liberation of Kuwait.
America disposed of its toxic waste problem by building radioactive depleted uranium right into their bombs and dropping them on Iraq. Bush Sr. not only devastated and poisoned Iraq's water systems and infrastructure, he weakened the economies of both Kuwait and Iraq, collected giant profits from rationed Iraqi food for oil programs, and landed massive rebuilding contracts in Kuwait. Bush Sr. followed up the Gulf War with 10 long years of deadly trade sanctions that killed another 1.5 million Iraqi people, including 600,000 children, who were cut off from medical supplies.
The bookstore in the United States today, you can find 50 books celebrating different aspects of the war and how grand it all was. And you only find one that points out that this was a war crime, and that demonstrates the evidence that shows that we deliberately targeted civilians and killed more than 250,000 people in Iraq.
You'll be fighting not to conquer anybody, but to liberate people.
But
in March 2003, President George Bush Jr. launched the second Gulf War. The war on Iraq wasn't about revenge for 9/11, since not one of the 19 accused terrorists were Iraqi citizens. It wasn't about weapons of mass destruction, which inspectors hadn't found. It wasn't even about Saddam Hussein, who had been financed into power by the U.S. in the first place and who got his chemical and biological weapons from American companies. No, the U.S. wars against Iraq and against Afghanistan were about mass murder and piracy. They were about big weapon sales, big oil, big pipelines, big drugs, and big rebuilding contracts. They were about colonizing the Middle East and moving two giant steps closer to world domination. But there is a more scientific explanation for their madness. For thousands of years, these families have practiced inbreeding between sisters and brothers, uncles and nieces, mothers and sons, to keep the power and wealth all in the family. This practice of inbreeding over thousands of years has produced a clever but pathological breed of conscienceless, sociopathic families who will stop at nothing to own every ounce of gold, every drop of water, and every blade of grass on planet Earth. The United Nations, which they founded and control, has clearly stated its goals of establishing a new world order, a UN standing army, and a global taxation system. The Queen's husband, Prince Philip, and Evelyn Rothschild have already established an interfaith declaration for the creation of one world religion. What would life be like in this world empire with one world religion, one world army, one world economy, one world court, one world media, one world government, and one world dictator? What the public doesn't know is that Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto and the Russian Constitution have been built into the UN Charter, and that the New World Order will be a communist world order. Peace on Earth will be a forced peace in which citizens will have no rights. No right to bear children without approval, no right to travel without authorization, no right to own private property, no right to privacy, no right to bear arms, no right to protest, no right to receive an inheritance, no right to choose an education or a job or even a place of residence, and worst of all, no right to live. The right to live will be based on an individual's rating of usefulness to the royal elite. In this planned world without borders or nations, citizens will be disarmed of all weapons, including handguns, and will have no means to protest, fight, resist, or challenge this one world authority who will control them spiritually, economically, and militarily. Every human being will be electronically tattooed and will become helplessly dependent on this one world authority for all of their most basic needs. The masses will eventually be taught to bow down and worship this one world dictator who will rule the entire world from his eternal throne in Israel. The big question is, who is this charismatic leader that the entire world would be willing to accept as their ruler? According to plan, this future world ruler will prove himself to be a descendant of Jesus Christ and Mary Magdalene, and will therefore be accepted by the Christian world. Some will even view him as the Savior and Messiah. As a professed descendant of Christ and a proponent of world religion, he will also be accepted by Buddhists, Hindus, and the Eastern world, where Jesus Christ reportedly lived, studied, and preached Eastern philosophy. Since he is a descendant of the Hebrew tribes of Israel, he will also be accepted by Hebrews and Jews worldwide. By marrying a Muslim woman, he will win the acceptance of the Muslim world. He will also be accepted by worldwide Freemasonry and secret societies, which he is a member of. As the son of Princess Diana, he is already loved and worshipped. When his mother died in the arms of a Muslim man in a Paris car crash, the world embraced him. On May 31, 2004, the Rothschild-controlled Associated Press published a photograph worldwide taken by Alastair Grant. The photo shows Prince William posing with a lamb like Jesus Christ, who the Bible calls the Lamb of God. What is the significance of this photograph? To the unaware observer, the photograph is perfectly innocent, but to insiders familiar with the protocols of Zion, Freemasonry, and the Book of Revelation, William is identified in the photo as the Antichrist. The Antichrist has been described in art and literature as handsome and charming and a master of lies and deception. Freemasons call him the Baphomet, or Goat of Mendes. He has also been described as the embodiment of evil and the enemy of God, and has been called Satan, Lucifer, Pan, the Beast, and Amun. He is commonly illustrated with cloven hind hooves. Why is Prince William holding up a cloven hind hoof in the photograph? The question of whether God or Satan even exists has been fiercely debated since the beginning of debate. Some people believe that God and Satan are inventions of the ruling class to control the masses. Most people acknowledge the existence of positive creative energy characterized by joy, love, and vitality, and the existence of negative destructive energy characterized by greed, hatred, and death. The triumph of evil in the world today is based on the ability of evil to disguise itself as its opposite and fool the masses. According to Masonic calculations, Prince William is predicted to be crowned world dictator in the year 2015 at the age of 33. Without organized intervention, life and peace on earth will take on a whole new meaning. How many people would be willing to play a game of Monopoly with real money if the banker was making up the rules, rigging the dice, stealing the money, cheating the players, and grabbing up all the properties? The answer is almost everybody. The truth is that only 1% of the world's population of over 6 billion people is controlling the other 99%. That 1% owns the world's banks and most of the world's wealth, land, and resources. So why is everybody passively cooperating with this madness? Because the wealthy 1% who write the rules have taught the other 99% to obey them, powerless to change things. When people feel powerless, they cling to passive attitudes, like ignorance is bliss, things aren't that bad, or let God take care of everything. Before choosing a passive attitude, remember that the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good people to do nothing. Despite all the red flags, many people deny that a problem even exists. It does exist, and the good news is there are solutions. The solutions lie in knowing what the three biggest fears of the world's ruling families are. The first biggest fear is exposure. They have gone to great lengths to cover up their trail of crimes and to win the public's trust through their media monopolies. Without public trust, their ancestral plan for global control is doomed. Their second biggest fear is losing public support. If the public stops cooperating, their plan is guaranteed to fail. Their third biggest nightmare is organized resistance by an informed and fearless public. The ruling families know from past experience that the will of the people can defeat all their military and monetary might. Vietnam is a perfect example. There is no doubt whatsoever that these ruling families can be totally defeated by turning their three worst fears into a reality. Solution number one is exposing the ruling families and their generations of horrific crimes against humanity. The most powerful form of advertising is word of mouth. Share information, talk about it, name names, recommend books, videos, and websites. Form your own study groups and solutions groups. Design a website, show videos, films, and DVDs. Raise money, give money, organize, lobby, email, and do whatever you can to stop the madness. Millions of people around the world who protested the invasion of Iraq learned a hard lesson. They learned that peaceful protests don't work. Since the Committee of 300 Families created think tanks to mastermind a plan for global control, citizens must also create think tanks to mastermind a plan to stop them. Learn who the past and present members of the Committee of 300 are. At the top of the list are the royal families of Britain and Denmark, the international banking families, and the affiliated political families. Find time to research and read about the Committee of 300. Dig beneath the hype and propaganda, connect the dots, and share your information. The second solution for ending the madness is to take back control over your own money. Right now, your money is in the hands of the ruling families who own all of the world's banks, including the privatized central banks. How did they get to be so powerful? It started with the very first banks. In the beginning, banks were a safe place for people to store their gold. When the bankers discovered that people left most of their gold in the bank for safekeeping, they started lending out the gold that didn't belong to them and charging interest on it. Soon, kings and royalty were borrowing gold from the bankers to finance wars. Since wars were extremely good for business, the bankers started stirring up conflicts that led to more wars. Then they lent money out to both sides of the wars and collected huge interest rates. Eventually, the bankers got so rich that they built banks all over the world. They made millions in interest just by loaning out other people's money that didn't belong to them. They bought mansions and fancy clothes and hosted extravagant parties. The royal families of Europe became the banksters' biggest customers and rewarded them with high society titles like lord and baron and sir. Using their money and royal influence, the banksters changed the laws of nations so they could put the world's central banks, mints, and money supply into private hands. Out of every $1,000 that each of their customers deposited in their bank, they kept only $100 on hand. They took the rest of their customers' money and made loans with it, invested it, and started up other businesses, like the steel business to create rail for their railway companies, to transport oil for their oil companies. Pretty soon, the banksters' new businesses grew into giant corporations. Those giant corporations turned the world's oceans, lakes, rivers, air, and soil into corporate toilets. When profits from all their oil, mining, and drug company monopolies soared, the banksters became the world's richest men, but their greed had no limits. They wanted to own the entire world, so they put their heads together and came up with an ingenious scheme to take control of all of the world's money and riches. Whoever owns all of the world's money, they said, owns the world. Using their media corporations, they launched a gigantic advertising campaign. They told people they no longer had to save up their money and wait for all the things they wanted in life. They could have everything they ever dreamed of right now. All they needed was a shiny plastic card. People rushed to fill up their wallets with shiny plastic cards instead of money. Like lottery winners, they went on drunken buying sprees and bought everything in sight. All the things they couldn't afford. Nobody even noticed when their hard-earned paychecks were automatically deposited in the bank without ever being cashed. Suddenly, people's bills, fines, taxes, and purchases were automatically deleted from their accounts, and paying by check quickly became unfashionable. Eventually, money was phased out altogether and replaced with units of credit, which were really nothing more than numbers on a computer screen. The next thing the banksters did was replace people's plastic cards with their newest invention, barcode tattoos. These barcode tattoos contained all of a person's private credit information and could be invisibly tattooed onto people's wrists. Since having a wrist tattoo was like having an invisible debit card, and since nobody could steal it from you, everybody rushed to get one. All people had to do to buy whatever they wanted in life was scan their wrist tattoo over a scanner. And so the power for people to buy their most basic necessities in life fell completely into the hands of the banksters. Suddenly, people couldn't buy food, medicine, or even a cup of coffee without scanning their wrist tattoos. Eventually, people sobered up from their drunken spending sprees. They realized they had traded their hard-earned money for nothing more than a bunch of numbers on a computer screen. Their real money had become virtually unreal. Not only did the banksters own all of the world's money, they now had the power to delete a person's lifetime of savings. But why would these friendly banksters do such an evil thing? To force people's cooperation. This futuristic scenario isn't as futuristic as it sounds. Invisible wrist tattoos with all of a person's credit information have already been developed. So what can you do to take back control over your money before the banksters phase out the world's money system? Withdraw your money from their banks. By putting your money in their banks, you are enriching and empowering them with control over your money and eventually over your life. Cut up your credit and debit cards. Pay only with cash or money order or certified check. What are you doing? People are under the illusion that their money is safe in the bank and that the banksters are honest. The truth is, the money you put in their banks isn't really there. Although there hasn't been a global economic crash since the 1930s, another crash could happen at any time and without warning. Economic crashes don't just happen. They are made to happen. Economic booms and busts are controlled by how much money the banksters put in circulation through their loans and interest rates. People believe Alan Greenspan, who announces U.S. interest rates, works for the Fed, and that the Fed is the U.S. government. The Fed is not the U.S. government. The Fed is the privately owned Federal Reserve banks, which are owned and controlled by the banksters. Every day, the banksters move trillions of dollars around the world's banking and financial markets. They decide if the markets go up or down, soar or crash. But why in the world would they want to crash the markets? To destroy people's confidence in the money system and create a dependent, cashless society. According to the Zionist plan written by Adam Weishaupt and Albert Pike, the ruling families will bankrupt the middle class and repossess their private property. They will reinstate the military draft and continue disarming nations until there's no one left to disarm. They will make it illegal to possess a firearm or any other weapons that could be used to resist them. When the crash does come, they'll blame it on the phony war on terror, which they control and finance on both sides. So what else can you do to take back control over your own money? Take all of your money out of the rigged stock markets and money markets. Cash in your treasury bills, bonds, and retirement savings plans. Most of the retirement funds have already been looted. Trade in your paper money for something of real value, like gold, silver, and precious metals and stones. So where can you put your cash and valuables besides the bank? In a personal safe or a very good hiding place. It will prove to be much safer than the bank. It's not the neighborhood thieves you have to worry about. It's the global thieves. By keeping your hard-earned money and valuables out of the banks and stock markets, you are depriving the banksters of money for their wars, weapons, and mass murder. You are taking back control of your own money. You know where it is, and it's available when you need it. No interest, no service charges, no bank machines. Many people are under the illusion that their money is printed by the government. Money is not printed by the government. It is printed privately by the banksters, who stamp it with their Masonic symbolism. Some community groups are creating their own system of money and buying and selling services and goods from each other tax-free. Monopoly money works great. So do IOUs and the barter system. When the crash does come, the markets and all of the banks will be closed for business. If and when they reopen again, your investments will be worth next to nothing, and your paper money will get you only 10 cents on the dollar.
They come like lights on the opening bell, but I've got the doctor coming more than 150 points.
If you think you own your car, your house, or other credit purchases, an economic crash will remind you of who the real owners are. Most people believe that their hard-earned tax money pays for things like roads, bridges, schools, and other public services. The truth is that every penny of your tax dollars pays for your nation's national debt to the banksters. The banksters then loan your hard-earned tax money back to your government and charge interest on it for your basic public services. Before the bombing and theft of the country of Iraq, every citizen in America owed the banksters $70,000 per citizen. Truth is that every penny of your tax dollars pays for your nation's national debt to the banksters. The banksters then loan your hard-earned tax money back to your government and charge interest on it for your basic public services. Before the bombing and theft of the country of Iraq, every citizen in America owed the banksters $70,000 per citizen. It is your skyrocketing debt and your nation's skyrocketing debt to the banksters that have helped them enslave the world, and they're doing it with your money, your labor, and your approval. Since the ruling families and their brotherhood of wealthy insiders hide their wealth and don't pay taxes, why should you? Find ways to avoid paying tax money to these gangsters. If you earn an average salary over your lifetime, you will pay the banksters more than $1 million in taxes. Three-quarters of your lifetime of work pays for your government's debt to the banksters and your personal debt to the banksters on your mortgage house, your car loan, student loans, and other loans. The bankster's game is all about taking your money in taxes and then loaning your money back to you again with interest. They take property taxes, gas taxes, food taxes, clothing taxes, and dozens of other taxes and fees. Collectively, the public willingly hands over trillions of dollars annually to the banksters by depositing money in their banks, paying taxes to their central banks, supplying labor to their corporations, buying stock in their corporations, and then spending savings in their corporate superstores. So what do the banksters do with all your money that they pocket? They bomb, rob, kill, colonize, exploit, and advance their cause for global control and for your eventual enslavement. A third solution is to refuse to fight the banksters' murderous wars and to stop supporting others who fight their wars. One of America's favorite slogans is, support your troops, which means support your troops no matter what, even if the war is a lie. Innocent families are being bombed, burned, and crippled with your tax money. Even if your tax money is paying teenagers in uniform to die by the thousands for the lie. The majority of recruited soldiers are naive, duped, unemployed teenagers who are romanced into believing they are heroes fighting for freedom. But what they are fighting for is the wealthy ruling families who are systematically disarming the world of all weapons of resistance to their global empire.
We taught you not to conquer anybody, but to liberate people.
A fourth solution is to stop voting. Most nations have two main political parties, which means there are only two candidates for the top job. One is a candidate for the very rich, and the other is a candidate for the even richer. Both candidates are sponsored by the lobby groups of the ruling family. Many voters feel a need to vote for the lesser of two evils, but they are still voting for evil and supporting a corrupt electoral system. Both John Kerry and George Bush are members of Yale University's Skull and Bones Secret Brotherhood, which is rooted in German Freemasonry. Not only are Bush and Kerry Skull and Bonesmen, they are also descendants of British royalty, the black nobility, and the Hebrew tribes of Israel. A fifth solution is to stop obeying laws designed to disempower you. The success of the ruling family depends on your obedience of their laws that they make and break, including the Ten Commandments. A sixth solution is to buy small and think big. Stop shopping at corporate superstores like Walmart or corporate grocery chains, which are owned by the ruling families. Buy from small businesses, farmers markets. Grow your own natural food. The banksters have been genetically modifying and patenting the food you eat, the seeds you need for growing food, as well as animal DNA. Corporate farming that supplies meat to corporate grocery stores subjects animals to painful, inhumane crowding, filth, cruelty, and abuse. A seventh solution is to stop donating to charities. Most of it pays administration fees. The ruling families have set up big charities and foundations to create a friendly, charitable image of themselves and to cover up their real agenda. Big charities serve as a hiding place to launder dirty money from the drugs and weapons trade. The Queen's husband, Prince Philip, is the international president of the World Wildlife Fund, which is one of the worst offenders. An eighth solution is to stop identifying with a flag or a national anthem. Refuse to sing praises to America's bombs bursting in air or to Britain's gracious and noble queen who is neither gracious or noble. A ninth solution is to refuse to recognize the illegitimate claims of the ruling families to your nation's water, land, resources, railways, airlines, power companies, health plans, and other publicly held properties that they have been busy privatizing while you were speaking. The ruling families have been stealing your nation's land and resources through corporate privatization, which means they've been buying up your nation's publicly owned property. And where is it all leading? To an eternal world empire in which the power of these ruling families can never be challenged, and the earth and all living things will be helplessly at their mercy. A tenth solution is to name names. Focus the blame where it belongs, on the ruling family, not on their faceless corporations. Corporations like WorldCom, Enron, Merrill Lynch, and Halliburton are owned by real people with real names and real faces. The general public is deceived into believing that ordinary people who invest and buy shares in these giant corporations actually own them. Nothing could be further from the truth. The only shares that really matter are the Class A shares, all of which are owned by the ruling family. Their hand-picked lackeys who sit in for them as company directors get shuffled around like packs of slippery cards. 11th solution is to reject the propaganda that keeps you passive. Bible believers are taught that an apocalypse and the reign of a satanic world ruler are inevitable because the Bible says so. Don't protest, don't resist, be passive. These messages are repeated over and over again to millions of Bible believers worldwide. Since the ruling families view religion as the opiate of the masses, they provide funding for organized religion worldwide. Christians, Muslims, and Jews have been tricked into praising their god Amun at the end of every prayer. A 12th solution is to arrest the committee of 300 ruling families for their horrific past and present crimes against humanity. Those crimes include genocidal mass murder using America's atomic and chemical weapons of mass destruction on Japanese and Vietnamese families. Hundreds of thousands of innocent human beings were burned, deformed, and vaporized with taxpayers' money. The ruling family's crimes also include espionage, drug trafficking, extinction of species through environmental rape and pollution, extreme degradation, humiliation, cruelty, and torture, blackmail, bribery, conspiracy, slavery, racism, and mass slaughter, ethnic cleansing. Their crimes include terrorism and the planning and cover-up of 9/11. There's grand theft, tax evasion, and insider trading. profiting from Hitler's Nazi labor camps and trading with the enemy, loan sharking, smuggling, corruption, political assassinations, and the list goes on. The committee of 300 inbred families are clever, ruthless, and morally insane. Since they control the military, the weaponry, and the world's wealth, who's going to arrest them for their horrific crimes, and how? The world's citizens must gather together in large numbers and make a citizen's arrest of each of these 300 families.
About the generations, and to say we want to make it a better place for our children and our children's children, so that they know it's a better world for them, and think they can make it a better place.
There's a place in your heart, and I know that it is love. Brighter than tomorrow. And if you really try, you'll find there's no need to cry. In a place you feel there's no hurt or sorrow. There are ways to get there if you care enough for the living. Make a little space, make a better place. Heal the world.
Better place for you and for me and the entire human race. There are people dying. If you care enough for the living, make a better place.
they're so